This is MSO News Sports. I'm Bill Newell, joined by Steve Krause, retired from the Daily Item of Lynn, longtime sports editor, news editor, features writer. So many different hats he's worn at the Item in Lynn. But Steve, welcome. Welcome back.
Thanks, Bill.
Steve, I think one of the biggest stories in Lynn over my years here on the North Shore was the Lynn Fire, the great Lynn Fire back in 81, I want to say. But tell us about that. You were working during the Lynn Fire and at the Item before you were sports in the sports department, but tell us that story.
That was it was almost, I think it was, I don't know whether it was the night after Thanksgiving or the week after Thanksgiving. I don't remember that far back, but I do remember that it was on a Friday night and it was going into Saturday morning, and I was the Saturday editor, which meant that I had to get there at the most ungodly hour of 2 o'clock in the morning to start work on the paper. And as I drove up, our police fire guy had been out, you know, picking up police logs. And back then, you had to write them, you know, copy them and write them. And it was just a long process. And he came back, and we both looked down Spring Street, which is the street that connected Exchange Street, which was where our building was on, to Broad Street. And at the bottom of that street, there was a building that was pretty much engulfed by fire. And we're looking at each other and we're saying, oh, good Lord, we got to deal with this. So then we go upstairs. We were on the second floor, and there's a big series of picture windows at one end of the room. And we look out the window and we realize it wasn't just one building engulfed. It was about three or four. And already by then, the place was just, you know, as we're looking at this, fire truck upon fire truck upon fire truck is coming up. And, you know, any place they can find to put the truck, they're putting them there. I go down the other end of the room where our desks were, and I called. First guy I called was John Moran, who was our managing editor. I got him out of bed, and he wasn't too happy to be roasted out of bed by me. I told him, I think this is a big one, John. You better get in here. And John said, oh, come on. I said, no, John, really. This is big. So he came in, and, you know, yes, it was. We called everybody we could think to call to get them to come in. This was one of those all-hands-on-deck situations. And I was the guy that was working the desk and putting out the paper. So I didn't actually go out and cover the fire. I had to stay in because I had to do all the editing and all the laying out. And we had all of our photographers in. It got so bad at one point that we couldn't develop our pictures because we didn't have enough water pressure, because all the water was being used to put the fire out. And it was a week-long process before that fire was actually, the all-clear was sounded. And by the time it was, the place looked like a bomb had hit it. I mean, you say that, you know, you walk into a messy room and you say, oh, God, this place looks like a bomb hit it. But no, this place looked like a bomb hit it. There was a story. Time magazine took a whole page, Bill. You know how Time is sparing with the words. They took a whole page with a big picture to cover that fire. And I swear to God, it looked like Berlin after the Blitz. It was just that. It looked awful. And at the time of the fire, a lot of those buildings, which are old, deserted shoe factories and everything, they were being earmarked for some serious urban renewal. And there were an awful lot of real estate developers who had an awful lot at stake with the property down there. And I remember them all congregating up in our office, looking out those second-floor windows. And, you know, some of them were crying. I mean, this was their dreams, just going up in smoke. we just had everybody, the Globe, all the TV stations, were all congregating up in our offices, and it was just like Grand Central Station. And it was, I mean, I don't know if this sounds awful to say, but, you know, for somebody that just liked this aspect of the business, at the same time it was horrifying to see, it was also exhilarating. Because you're in the middle of it, and there's—I don't know if how much of a theater buff you are, but there's a play called Hamilton, right? It would have been hard for you to miss that, right?
No, I'm aware of Ham. I've not seen Hamilton, but I'm aware of Hamilton. Yes.
There's a song in Hamilton that Aaron Burr sings. It's called "The Room Where It Happened." And that's why I always saw this as, for me, is it was a way for me to be in the room where it happened, whether it was the Lynn fire, you know, watching the Pope say mass on the Boston Common, or the Super Bowl, or, you know, watching St. Mary's win a hockey title. You know, it was all the same to me. You're in the room where it happened. You know, in some way, shape, or form, history is being made. And you're there to see it. I honestly can't think of anything cooler than that.
No, I agree with you. You've got my mind straying in a couple of different directions here. Let me just follow up on the one thought of the Lynn fire is that my one story about the Lynn fire, like all the things you're telling about was your vantage point. The one big thing that I remember that I remember to this day, I'm pulling out in the morning on that Saturday. To go to the radio station. I think we had a Saturday morning sports show. And I'm leaving Parkland Avenue, which you know, heading to turning into Wyoming Square. And before I get there, a red police station wagon drives by from Lexington. And I go, that's weird, seeing a Lexington fire car go by. It wasn't a truck. It was a car. There might have been trucks afterwards. But that's the one thing that I do remember. And not knowing anything at all about the fire at that point. I think it's one of those things you wake up early, you throw your clothes on and you're out early. It was one of the early mornings. And so, like you said, you know, that, you know, then that was the story, and you're right. You know, this will be the 40th anniversary of it coming up this fall. So I imagine the item must have a lot of those old photos. And the other thing you talk about, we talked about it in our earlier segment, how technology has changed things, but digital photos, everything's now digital. So it's not that hard to take a photo, bring it back, put it into the paper today. But back then, you're right, you had to develop them all. I'm glad you reminded me of that piece. That's something that we forget about, that took time to do all that.
Yeah, and we had the most amazing police photographer that the North Shore has ever seen in Walter Hoey.
Oh, yeah, Walter, yeah.
Walter, I remember Walter, I went out for maybe 10 minutes because I just wanted to get a whiff of it, so to speak. And Walter was coming up Spring Street, and he says, "Feel my hair." So I felt his hair, and his hair was so stiff. The heat from the fires had, you know, pretty much binded his hair together. So I went down to take a look, and one of the lieutenants that was on duty was a guy by the name of Dick Biagiotti. Dick's no longer with us, but Dick came. I went down there, and Dick Biagiotti stops me. And he says, "Steve, don't go down there. It's too hot. You'll get literally burnt." So, how bad could it be? You know. So I went down there, and sure enough, I got about another 10 feet, and this wave of heat came over me, and I had to turn around and walk back. And Biagiotti says, "Steve, you don't listen." And I never appreciated what it was like to fight a fire, you know? I always watched things from afar. And one of the things about this business that I always appreciated was you didn't get to watch things from afar. You got to be right there. And your job kind of gave you access to things that you wouldn't have had otherwise. And, I mean, beyond the fact that you were professional, you had a job to do, that part of it was really neat, you know, that you were right there. You know, you didn't have to rely on reading about it. You were the one that was telling people about it.
Yeah, you're leading me into my last thought that I left hanging there before, Steve, that I wanted to mention, and that is when you cover a story, and you are right about, you know when you cover a big story, you know it's a big story. Whether in many cases in sports, it's the Thanksgiving Day game that automatically elevates it to a certain level of bigness, if you will, and it's always exciting. And I always, you know, when I got into covering sports, I realized, when you cover one team, it's kind of nice because you get to know the players, you get to know the game, and you know the game through a team, so to speak, even though every week they're playing somebody else, or every night, or different, you know, whether it be college hockey or basketball or whatever, it's a different opponent, but you're seeing the same players, you know, the same players every night when they play. But then, you're also talking with the participants, whether it be the players or the coaches, pregame, postgame, all that stuff. And that adds these layers, which I think you're kind of referring to, of understanding and appreciating the game and our own. It's kind of why you kind of get into it and like it, because you're at that level. You're not just watching from whatever row in the stands. You're much more involved with that than that.
Well, the first thing is you feel like you're a part of it. You know, I always...
You know, Steve, let me interrupt you, because you're right. You do feel like a part of it, but you know that you're really not a part of it at some level, but yet you are. I get it. No, totally.
You know, I don't know. I felt like I was a part of it. You know, there, in every situation that you deal with in public life, there are layers and layers and layers and layers of involvement, but you're all part of the fabric. And I always kind of looked at it that way. We were part of the fabric. We might not have been, you know, the part that you saw, but we were part of what went into it. And I say that because of this. A lot of these kids that play high school sports, they rely on the coverage that they get, because it ends up being put in the hands of admissions directors, you know, college scouts, college evaluators, and things like that. And it ends up in kids' portfolios that they then take to colleges that they can show at their interviews and things like that. So it's, in that sense, yes, you are part of the fabric, and you do feel fortunate, but you also feel like a huge responsibility. To serve these people that allow you into their domains every week, to serve them well and to serve them fairly and accurately. Because of that, I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but it's a very nice feeling to know, for example, as I was told once by somebody who was taking her son up to Middlebury College in Vermont for an interview, armed with a scrapbook that had about 6 or 7 of my articles in the scrapbook. And, you know, she said, you know, you have no idea the ripple effect of what you do and what it, where it goes. And, yeah, I never thought of it that way, but sure. But at the same time, that's a nice feeling. You also feel like, oh, my God, you know, I have this tremendous responsibility to represent this entire fabric well and accurately. That was our job. You know, coaches have their jobs, we have ours. And ours is to accurately and fairly reflect what goes on in these games. And I have no use for people who don't do that.
No, you know, you nailed it. And, you know, the other thing too, Steve, is that I'm glad you mentioned that, because how many, you know, over the years, you know, I'm going to guess here, I may be wrong on this, but I'm going to guess that that there are less people doing this now than there used to be. But back years ago, every family, if their son or daughter was mentioned in an item article, boom, they'd clip it out, or any of the local papers, they'd clip it out, they'd save it, it'd be in a scrapbook, it'd be in a folder, whatever. And you're right. People have those memories. It's a snapshot. It's like a photo or a photo album for sure. Yeah.
Fred Goddard, who was a one of those editors I talked about before that you quaked in fear in the presence of, he once told me that when I was writing it, and I was grousing about the fact that I had to do this, these briefs, you know, and who cares about this guy went in the service and that guy made the honor roll and stuff like that. And, you know, I had just come over from UPI, and I might have, for maybe a little while anyway, thought that those kinds of things were beneath me. And Fred set me straight right away. He just looked at me and he said, "That little brief that you think is so insignificant is going to be on somebody's refrigerator for the next 25 years. And absolutely, he nailed that. Absolutely. So you got you understood that regardless of what it was, what you were writing about, if it was a name and if it was an achievement, somebody was going to take that thing and put it on their refrigerator. And by the time it came off, it was going to be 57 different shades of yellow for how long it had been there. And you learned that there is no such thing as an insignificant story. And you learned that you had to do due diligence to everything that you did, because everything that you did meant something to somebody."
You know, I want to follow up, and this kind of leads me into one of the other areas I did want to talk to you about, is that the job of the local reporter, whether it be news or sports, in the newspaper business, and that, you know, I've covered college sports, I've covered pro sports. When you walk into a college game, you're handed media notes with team stats and paragraphs and snippets of players and the team. Same with the pros, obviously. Things to watch, keys of the game. You're handed all that stuff. When you cover a high school event or any other news locally, no one's doing that for you. There's none of that for the most part. You know what I mean? You don't get handed game notes. Every once in a while, you run into a coach that hands out something, but that's rare, and God bless them. But you know what I'm saying is that work is harder. And so, and when you mention about being set straight, I remember being set straight, you know, coming to the area and learning about covering local sports. Like, this is a special area. It requires, a real mindset like you're describing. Not that it's hard, I get it, but you need to develop that mindset of what it's all about. And it took me a while to learn that, I'm sure. But once you learn it, man, you love it. You know what I'm saying? And you love the people.
I remember, I was never that was never my strong suit. Statistics and things like that. You had to do it because you have to have a point of reference. You know, if you end up with Dick Geron in your coverage area, and now your job is to cover Dick Geron, well, you're not just measuring Dick Geron against some other kid from Swampscott. You know, when you think about it for a minute, you're measuring Dick Geron against Harry Aginis, you know, against all of these greats from different eras, because Dick Geron is in that, he's in that conversation, you know? So now what you have to do is you got to go back and you got to find out, well, what did Harry do? All right, was he really as great as everybody said he was? So you got to go find somebody that has some statistics on Harry. And we used to have a guy that lived in Saugus named Bob Walsh. He had every statistic on everybody. He would be the guy that you would go to for something like that. Now it's a guy named John McCann from 80s era Lynn Classical. He just has all these statistics coming out of every part of his body. Billy Kaporis and Paul Halloran are two of the best. Billy was, obviously, Paul is one of the best when it comes to stuff like that. So if I need something, you know, I know that I can call Paul, and generally he'll either have it or know where I can get it. It's good to know who these people are, because you're going to need them. You're going to need them to be able to kind of guide you to these things. But if you do this kind of a job, you just have to know that it's going to come up, and you're going to have to measure these athletes against other athletes from the past. And the better the athlete is, the wider the net is for comparing. And I've done that with, I did that with Scooney Penn. And remember Scooney? How can you forget Scooney?
No, I remember Scooney, yeah.
Remember Scooney Penn? We've had many football players. And when you get down to saying, okay, how good is this guy really? And so you go into the old scrapbook and get the statistics. And sports, a big part of covering sports, obviously, is numbers. And who's got what batting average? How many touchdown passes did this kid throw? You know, the last one that I remember that had us all diving for the record books, really diving for the record books, is probably the Beatrice kid from Swampscott, Kyle Beatrice. There have been good players since, but I think that he's the last one that, you know, you actually said, oh, all right, how does he rate against the best quarterbacks in the state overall? And he stacked up pretty good, as I recall.
Hmm. Steve, I want to touch on one last area here with you in this segment, and that would be, we talk about kind of developing to be local reporters, and it's just, I would say that it's a specialized field, if you will. Not impossible, as you say, not necessarily difficult, but specialized. And I always think when I get the item, I'm looking at the bylines, the different names, the new names that are there reporting that weren't there 10 years ago. There's been some turnover at the item, a lot of new young faces, I think, reporting. And I know I got to think one of your roles, we haven't talked about this, we haven't rehearsed this, but I got to think because of your roles in the last several years at the item. When a story broke that involved kind of a historical piece to it, you got that assignment because you have the institutional knowledge of whether it be the city of Lynn or the North Shore that you know these people. You just dropped some great names during this podcast so far. That would not necessarily be household names to everyone, but maybe to you and me, we know these names. And I got to think that, you know, kind of the, I'll call it staff development, but kind of the development that you've been working on, you've got to have been doing that with some of the newer item reporters over the last several years. Does that make sense to you, what I'm saying?
It does. I'm laughing because institutional knowledge means old. I guess that means I'm old. But
Steve, it's a wonderful way of saying it, though, I think.
Yeah, you're right, though. That kind of came to pass last November because we were sitting around trying to figure out what can we do the week of Thanksgiving to mitigate the fact that there wasn't going to be any Thanksgiving football. You know, for the first time in 42 years, I have a Thanksgiving that I don't have to worry about where I need to be. So, as an aside, so what do? I burn my thumb taking a pan out of the oven. That's another story for another day. But, so what we chose to do was focus, because it's the Lynn, the item was basically based in Lynn. We focused on some of the more astounding classical English football games. And mine was pretty easy. It was actually fairly recent. It was when the kid ran the kickoff back for a touchdown to win the game for classical. And but we did retrospectives on some of the people, some of the names, some of the developments that took place over the years during the game. There was one year we did a podcast with an interview of people who had taken part, had been a big part of all the rivalries, which went well. Because I consider Lynn sports people to be very historically oriented. They're always looking to compare this guy with that guy and this team with that team. And we also had a... Earlier this year, the Lynn Museum went back and did a whole thing on Lynn Classical's 1980 basketball team, which is one of the best basketball teams there's ever been in the city. There's just so much. And, yeah, I got to be part of a lot of it because I was around for a lot of it. You know, but then the other thing that's really strange, though, Bill, is that your memory does play tricks on you. I had certain, what I thought, vivid memories of some of these games, and then I went back and did the research, and it was not like that at all. I remember about 20 years ago, Lynn had four teams make their divisional sectional finals in basketball on the same day. Something that's kind of etched in my memory forever because it was so much fun. But circumstances surrounding each of the games that got them there were a little bit different than I remember them. So as institutional as your knowledge might be, it's no substitute for actually getting in there and doing the research.
Yeah, and you know, again, let me go back to one of the points we made just a moment ago, Steve, about being there, covering things, talking to the people involved with these teams and players and so on. I covered the 1980 Lynn Classical boys basketball team, so I know, you know, I remember that, and to have been there to cover some games, I can't remember details. I really can't, but when you mention that team, man, those players just it was a special time for classical basketball for sure.
Oh yeah, it was a show one night. Yeah. You know, you go there and you know there was always this undercurrent of the coach at the time was a guy by the name of Louis Falkoff. You remember Lou?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Louis, the word was that Louis didn't do a whole lot of coaching. That he was it was very typically Louis would give them the basketball and say, here, go play. And they went and played. I don't subscribe to that, really. I think that, you know, there's got to, even if he's not the strongest sheriff in town, there's got to be a sheriff or else things go haywire really quick. But I also think that what people mistake that for is Louis was smart enough to get out of the way. You know, there is something to be said for getting out of the way. But every time you went to one of those games, you saw something you never saw before.
Yeah.
And it was just astounding. And, you know, those guys have all on their own done okay, you know.
But, you know, Steve, I mentioned that the other day, not the part about Coach Falkoff, but you're right. But that in itself is the texture or dynamic of that team at that time. That's what people said. But, you know, I want to bring one other name up to you, Tom Grassa. Tom Grassa was an assistant coach on that classical bench during that time under Coach Lou Falkoff. And not until this past basketball season, I think, when Jasper Grassa was no longer the coach at Classical High School, his son, there was a Grassa on that classical coaching bench for since that time.
Yeah, Tommy was, of course, in his own right, a legendary coach.
Absolutely, yeah.
At Classical. And, you know, he got them to, he was the one, they went back-to-back state championships with Tommy Grassa as the coach. He was no slouch. He was also, I always thought he was a really good guy. Albeit different kind of a coach than Louis was, because Tommy was way more hands-on. But, again, I think the art of being a good coach at any level is to know just how hands-on you have to be and just how loose you have to let the reins. I mean, obviously, you have talented kids like those guys. You just say, here's the ball. Have fun, you know? And people look at that as bad, but I don't think it's bad. I think that's tremendous common sense to just know that, all right, you know, you can't be so controlling that you rob these kids of what they do best.
Yeah. But again, I go back and say that the whole Grassa connection, because I don't know how long he was an assistant under Coach Falkoff, but clearly back in 1980 he was, and like I said, until this past year, that is quite a run for sure for Grassa's in classical basketball, which is a program which was prominent high school basketball program over the years on the North Shore, for sure. Steve, I'm going to stop here, but we'll continue on here, but probably, I'm sure. But Steve, hang on with us here. We've been talking with Steve Krause, retired from the Daily Item of Lynn. I'm Bill Newell on MSONewsSports.com.